Chapter 39. Tamara Elkin tried pouring Jesse another drink, but he waved her off. She decided she'd had enough as well and put the bottle back in the kitchen. When she came back into Jesse's living room, she plopped herself down in his recliner across from the sofa on which Jesse had kicked up his feet. Neither of them spoke, and neither of them seemed the least bit uncomfortable. Then she became aware of Jesse staring at her hair. "Many men have tried to figure out the enigma that is my hair, Jesse Stone," she said, a laugh in her voice, "and many have failed." "Any live to tell the tale?" "The lucky ones." He shook his head at her, smiled, but she noticed something off in his smile. She asked, "What's wrong?" "Nothing." "Come on, Jesse. We've been friends for, what, 2 days? And no offense, but you're not as inscrutable as you'd like to believe you are. So let's hear it." She crooked one of her long, tapered fingers at him and wiggled it. "Something's bothering you. Besides, isn't sharing part of the whole friendship thing?" "The panties," he said. "I don't know about you. You're sending me mixed messages there, Chief. I thought discussing my underwear was off limits if we were going to be pals." "Not yours. Maxie Connolly's." She laughed that deep laugh of hers. "You, sir, are a unique individual. Given my chosen career, you can imagine I've had some strange discussions in my time, but discussing a dead woman's missing panties is a first." He smiled, but again it was a troubled smile. "It's more than her panties," he said. "Her handbag and cell phone are missing, too." "I can't help you there. But like I said on the phone, some gals do go commando style. And from what the buzz is around about her, it seems to me that the late Maxie Connolly might have been a prime candidate for AARP Commando of the Year Award."
"If all that was missing was her panties, it wouldn't bother me as much. I saw surveillance video of her leaving her hotel room with her bag, and she went straight from the hotel to the Bluffs."
Tamara asked, "How did she get there?"
"Cab."
"Well, Sherlock, you might want to have a talk with the cab driver."
"Did that."
"And?"
"And I think I'd better go have another talk with him," Jesse said. "And you, Doc, I think it's time for you to get going."
"You sure?"
"Positive. We can't do friendly sleepovers every night."
"Tempted?"
He said, "I didn't think there was any question of that."
Tamara stood, "Just checking. You know, I won't hold it against you if you give in to it on occasion."
"But I will."
She wagged a finger at him. "Oh, you're one of those."
"One of those what?" Jesse asked.
"Moralist."
He tilted his head. "I wouldn't say that."
"What would you say?"
"That I can usually sense right from wrong."
"I don't know, Jesse. I look at the world and the bodies that come into my morgue, and I wonder if I know what's right anymore."
"Let's say I know what's wrong. Easier to know what's wrong."
"You're an interesting man, Jesse Stone, but you're out of place here."
"In paradise?"
"Yes, but that's not what I mean exactly," she said. "I mean, you were born in the wrong century. You should have been sheriff in a small frontier town."
He didn't say anything to that because he'd had that same thought 1,000 times himself. It was one of the reasons he loved westerns so much. As a kid, he often pictured himself as the sheriff in High Noon, or as Wild Bill Hickok cleaning up Dodge City. When he thought about it seriously, Jesse realized that right and wrong probably weren't any less complicated back then, but it was easier to pretend they were. When Tamara had gone, Jesse sat in front of the TV and clicked through the channels, looking for a Western.
Chapter 40. Jesse tried to reconcile the size of the closed white coffin with the skeleton of the girl inside. He tried to reconcile the images of the girl, of her mugging for the camera with Molly and Ginny, with the dirty bones found in a hole on Trench Alley. He stopped soon after he began. These weren't the kinds of things Jesse focused on. He didn't see the point. The dead were just that, dead. If humans possessed souls, and if there was something that came after this world, Mary Kate's had gone there a long time ago. The rest of it, these few hours at the funeral home, were for the less fortunate, the ones left behind to suffer.
Jesse made his appearance at the funeral home before receding into the backdrop. He paid his respects to Tess O'Hara and Mary Kate's sisters and their families. One of the grandkids looked a lot like her late aunt. Mary Kate's father was nowhere in sight. No surprise in that. But Jesse was surprised by the paltry turnout. Then he remembered what Healy had said to him about small towns and shame. They all just wanted to forget, to go to work, come home and have dinner with their families, watch TV and be left alone. They wanted to forget. It was Jesse's job to remember. He had given Molly the day off to attend the wake and the service, but she came and sat beside him in one of the empty back rows of folding chairs at the funeral home. Molly's jaw was clenched tightly. Lately, that seemed to be her default expression. The rest of her face was blank, her eyes far, far away. "Do you think she'll be lonely, Jesse?" Molly said, her voice a brittle whisper. "How do you mean?" "She's had Ginny there to hold her all these years. Now..." Jesse turned to stare at Molly. This was a side of her he had never before seen. He understood that she felt guilty about something. Maybe that she had lived happily all these years, had raised a family and built a career, while her friends had been murdered and left to molder in a filthy hole in a forgotten building. But Jesse sensed there were other things at play here, and there was a question he had wanted to ask her from the very start, that in deference to their relationship he had not asked. He had hoped she would just come to him and explain, but she hadn't. He thought, for both of their sakes, the time had come to ask the question. "Come with me," he said, standing and walking out back of the funeral home. Snow was falling in big, lazy flakes. A white dusting covered the few cars that would follow the hearse to Sacred Heart Catholic Church. They stood close to each other, under an overhang. "What?" she asked. "You know what." "No, I don't." "If Mary Kate was your best friend, and Ginny was a friend of yours who grew up only two houses away from you, why weren't you there that night?" Molly looked as uncomfortable as Jesse had ever seen her. He put his hand on her shoulder, friend to friend. Molly's mouth opened and closed. No words came out. She was torn. He repeated the question. "Why, Molly?" "Mary Kate and I were fighting over a boy. We hadn't spoken to each other in weeks." "The boy who you mentioned when we were on Stiles Island? Was he who you were fighting over?" Molly nodded, looking very stoic. "What was his name?" "Warren. He went to Sacred Heart Boys." "Older?" "I don't want to talk about this, Jesse." "I know you don't, but you have to talk about it to someone. Not now. Not today, of all days." "Did Mary Kate take Warren away from you, Molly?" "Please, Jesse, stop. I can't do this now." Jesse took his hand off her shoulder and watched her head back inside. He had been in therapy long enough to know that Molly would tell him when she was ready and not before. Jesse turned his attention to the weather, looked at his watch, and decided he'd better get over to the church. Chapter 41. Sacred Heart Catholic Church was a little out of place in Paradise. It was too large for a small town. It was more suited to Boston or New York. A Gothic revival structure built from great blocks of light gray stone turned nearly black with a century's worth of coal dust and oil soot. The church was impressive to behold, made even more so by its position atop the highest point in town, inland of the bluffs. When its stone steeple and cross were lit up, they were visible for miles around. The rest of the campus, the school buildings, garages, and other structures were far more mundane. Jesse parked his Explorer perpendicular to the church entrance, but down the hill a bit and behind some ivory-covered fencing. It gave him a very good view of things without making his presence obvious to the attendees. He wanted to sit back and observe from a distance. He was hoping to see an unexpected mourner, a face that didn't seem to belong. The turnout at the funeral home had been so small, and no one there had seemed out of place. Sacred Heart was something else. It was large enough that you could slip in and out unnoticed. You could be a silhouette in a back pew if you wished. Jesse didn't know that he expected much in the way of results. He had made so little headway so far that he was willing to give it a try. He called into the station while he waited for the hearse to show.
Suit, I'm at the church. The guy's in place. They'll keep the media away from the family as best they can.
Okay, anything else?
Police chief from Helton called. Alicia Dragow's alibi checks out for the night Maxie Connolly killed herself.
I figured.
The road's bad out there?
You making small talk with me, Suit?
I'm going nuts in here, Jesse.
So you've said.
Sorry.
You'll get back on the street when I'm ready to put you there.
Jesse tapped the end call button on the touchscreen. The fact was that Jesse didn't know he would ever feel right about putting Suit back on the street. Suit's getting shot the way he did had thrown Jesse a curve he didn't know how to hit. He stared at the phone in his palm, thought about finally making that call to Dix. Somebody rapped their knuckles against the driver's side window. Jesse, trying very hard not to look startled, turned to see Stu Cromwell lurking. He lowered the window.
Jesse.
Stu?
You here on official business, or are you going to the service, Jesse?
I could ask you the same thing.
Cromwell said, Since we're talking, let me ask. You got anything for me?
Maybe I do. We can't locate some of Maxie Connolly's personal effects. Items we know she must have had with her when she went up to the bluffs.
Like what?
Her cell phone, for one, Jesse said.
Anything else?
Yes.
You're not going to tell me, are you?
Not yet. But you should get some mileage out of that.
Some.
I'm sure the missing stuff will turn up. That makes one of us, Jesse said.
How was the turnout at the viewing?
Light. The family, Molly and me, but only a few other people.
Cromwell nodded.
Makes sense.
Not to me.
It's a black mark against the town. Paints everybody who lives here with a big, broad brush. They all just want it to go away. In a sense, they're punishing the girls for going missing and getting killed. None of them would tell you that, but deep down, that's what's going on.
Captain Healy said something like that to me, Jesse said.
Smart man.
Jesse turned to look at the newspaper man. You all right, Stu? You don't look like you've slept in a week.
Rough night with Martha, he said. Lots of bad nights lately.
Sorry to hear it.
I'm going to get up to the church now, Jesse.
Jesse closed the window and watched Cromwell make his way up the hill in the snow. He noticed that people were beginning to show. He recognized most of them. Saw Molly arrive with her mom. He noticed Bill Marchand's SUV pass by the church and pull into the lot.
Jesse was willing to bet Marchand was the only politician who'd show his face today.
When the selectman approached the church entrance, he turned and spotted Jesse's explorer. He smiled, waved, then made his way down the hill.
When Jesse lowered his window, Marchand offered his right hand. Jesse shook it.
Any progress, Jesse?
None.
I'll keep the mayor off your back as long as I can.
Appreciate it.
I don't know how much good it's going to do. The funerals are going to amp up the pressure on your department to get these murders solved.
You mean the pressure on me?
I do.
I'll live with it.
What are you doing parked down here? Marchand asked.
Watching.
For?
For faces that don't fit.
Sounds like you're grasping at straws.
Jesse shook his head. Never understood that expression.
Me either.
They both laughed.
It's a sad day, though, Marchand said.
Did you know the girls?
I was older, but I knew who they were.
Paradise is a small town, Jesse. It was even smaller back then.
As a selectman, I just felt like I had to make an appearance.
Jesse didn't say anything, but he was caught off guard by how closely Bill Marchand's words paralleled what Alicia Dragow had said on the subject. But he wasn't exactly shocked.
Healy and Stu Cromwell were right. Everyone in Paradise had found a way to distance themselves from the girl's disappearance, and now the discovery that they had been murdered. It felt to Jesse almost as if they had all rehearsed the same answers, answers that were meant to insulate them from the horror and the guilt.
It wasn't hard to understand.
Then he saw a vehicle pull up to the church that got his full attention.
Jesse said, Isn't that Alicia Dragow's pickup?
Marchand shook his head in disgust.
That's his rusty POS, all right.
Wonder what he's doing here.
Got me.
Marchand patted Jesse's shoulder.
I better show my face up there now, Jesse. By the way, I ordered those new softball uniforms.
Jesse nodded, but he was barely conscious of Bill Marchand. All he could think about was Alicio Dragao, and why the fisherman kept turning up in the middle of things.